I think I love Kathy and Stella so much because it allows me to tap into the goofy side of me.
Hello and welcome to In the Frame. I'm your host and West End Frame editor, Andrew Tomlins. And today's guest is choreographer and now director, Fabian Aloise. Fabian is the co-director and choreographer of Kathy and Stella Solve a Murder, which is about to open in the West End following two runs at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, as well as a tour. He is also preparing to make his Broadway debut as the choreographer of Sunset Boulevard, starring Nicole Scherzinger and directed by Jamie Lloyd, having received an Olivier Award nomination for his work on the West End production. Fabian originally did episode 4 of this podcast, so I'm delighted that 227 episodes later, he is back for round 2. Back then, Fabian had just choreographed Evita at Regent's Park, having choreographed shows like The View Upstairs, The Rink, Madagascar, Our House, and Working. Since then, Fabian choreographed the first international non-replica production of Wicked in Hamburg, Germany, the London production of Bring It On, Cabaret in Paris, SpongeBob on Tour, and In Dreams, which so far has had runs in Leeds and Toronto. Fabian is originally from Canada. He trained as a ballet dancer in Australia, but after being told he wouldn't make it as a ballet dancer, pursued a career in musical theatre. After working extensively as a performer, which included him appearing in many West End musicals, Fabian agreed working as an assistant, associate, and resident choreographer before working as a choreographer in his own right. We had lots to delve into. Fabian's career right now is fascinating because, like, Sunset Boulevard couldn't be any more different to Kathy and Stella and many of his other recent projects. He's going in so many different directions and working on so much cool, exciting, cutting-edge stuff. And we discussed it all. For context, we had this chat the morning after the Olivier Awards. Here is the interview. Fabian Aloise, you're back in the frame.
It's crazy. It's been 5 years.
5 years.
This is like episode 5,682. And I was episode 4.
You did episode 4. And I've had a lot of chat since then.
Yeah. But we've had a pandemic.
I know.
And we survived.
I know. And then it's all been leading up to this.
Yeah. Oh my God, and I'm back in a padded cell.
I know. I'm very pleased to have you back in a padded cell. How, for context of people listening, because this will go out in like a month's time, but this is the day after the Olivier Awards. You have been busy recently. It's all going on. So yeah. Right here, right now, how are you?
I'm tired, but good. It's a good tired. It's a tired that you can kind of work through because it's so exciting. Stuff is really, really exciting. I got back from New York 2 weeks ago from a casting session that lasted a month.
Wow. For Sunset?
For Sunset, yeah. And, oh, the talent out there is so incredible. Mm-hmm. I have to say, after a month, you do start to miss home after about a month. And now I'm into pre-production for Kathy and Stella Solve a Murder.
Do you think over the last 5 years since I've seen you, obviously there was a pandemic and stuff, have you like taken in all the stuff that's happened? Have you like taken a moment to be like, gosh, because, you know, Evita just happened, you're in a massive trajectory, stuff was happening, I feel like eyes were on you as someone to watch, as someone who was doing great work, but then boom, you know, some stuff has exploded recently. And also you've gone down some really different avenues, which we'll get into, which have been surprising and exciting and different and fresh. So have you had a moment to be like, wow?
Not until you've just asked me that. Honestly, it feels like I've been trying to scramble back from the pandemic. I think a lot of creatives have felt the same, from people that I've spoken to in the industry. A lot of people in the industry have felt the same, that you just kind of... that bicycle that we were on is now like it's on a hill and it's not going very fast. And so you're scrambling to kind of get momentum back. The last year, I think I coasted a little bit on that bike because I had overlapping jobs. I was very, very fortunate. And a lot's come from them. So that's fantastic. But it was a bit of a slog coming out of the pandemic. Like everybody else, it was like, what's happening? You know, this is such weird terrain to navigate. But yeah, it's a lot more exciting now.
I also feel like, I mean, last time you came in, you were a choreographer. You were a fairly established choreographer. You worked on amazing jobs, right? But people almost still knew you quite well for your performing stuff and your performing career and how you made that transition. But now, do you, I mean, Fabian Aloise is an incredible choreographer from Sunset Boulevard and, you know, Kathy and Stella and all these shows. Do you wake up and you do feel like you're a choreographer?
I wake up and when I'm having my cup of tea, I think to myself, I'm a choreographer. I think I always have been a choreographer. I remember, I know we've talked about her before, but my dear friend Anne Reinking passed away during the pandemic. Yeah. And I remember she was the first person that said to me, you're a choreographer, when she was working with me as a dancer, because I always gravitated towards taking the material and then creating something new with it. And she was the first person to say, you're going to be a choreographer. And at the time, I remember thinking, that's not what I want. I don't want to be. I want to be one of your best dancers. I want to be the one in the spotlight. And now in hindsight, I see exactly what she meant. And I see what she sees in other people that I work with. And I can see that same spark. Because, you know, you meet a lot of dancers, you meet a lot of performers, but there you come across these people every now and then, and I recognize myself in them. And I think that's what she was doing then. She recognized herself. You know, you got a little bit more to give to the industry than just being in the spotlight. And I think that's quite cool.
That's exciting. Yeah. Because we are a podcast, we're doing a podcast, it seems fitting that we discuss Kathy and Stella first.
Kathy and Stella's Murder Podcast.
A podcast, yeah. A podcast. We're on a podcast talking about a musical about a podcast. It feels quite apt.
It's like a strange loop of Murder Podcast.
So when... I mean, I mentioned you've almost done some different things that have almost kind of, I think, surprised people. And for me, this is it, because you co-directed this, right, as well as choreographed it.
Yeah.
And it is a completely different style of show, not just to what you've worked on, but to what we see broadly, to what happens in the industry, to the type of stuff that's on stage. And also went to Edinburgh Fringe and really built up momentum. And it's kind of been, I think, really savvy in its journey and how it's got people to kind of go, oh, hang on, like, people are talking about this show. Why am I hearing about this show? What is going on here almost? That's how your audiences are kind of going in, I think. And now it's coming in for its West End run, which is
so
exciting.
It's coming in. It's been a long time coming. This is the third year. John Britton and Matthew Floyd Jones wrote this during lockdown. And the incomparable Francesca Moody, producer of all producers, I cannot sing her praises more. She is class personified and an exquisite dresser. If you ever see her on the street, she always looks impeccable. Like, we all secretly want to be her. It's not a secret anymore. And we were due, I was asked to come in as movement director because it was going to be in the round. And John Britton knew that everything was going to basically be created for the round, and he needed to bring on a choreographer, a movement director. And then I think it was in the first week of rehearsals, he turned to me and he just said, do you want to just direct the next scene as well? And how about you direct the next one as well? And it became this sort of collaboration that I had never really had with anybody else, because I've collaborated with loads of other directors and it's mainly been all right, transition into the choreography, or let me know what it is you want from the choreography. But I had never really been asked to, the faith had been put into me to kind of decipher how to stage this, how to get the emotion out. And so John and I put our heads together, and it's been one of the best collaborations I've had ever. And we've become very, very close friends. Actually, all of us are very, very close. It's not something that I ever thought I was going to do. I know how to direct movement. I think the joy out of Kathy and Stella is the ability to direct good comedy. And John Britton is an impeccable comedic writer. I mean, he's a brilliant writer in all sense, but he can write some amazing comedy. And to be able to facilitate that onto the stage is, it's just incredible.
Also, people...
Hi, I'm Marcus Mazzell, host of Past Present Feature, a filmmaker appreciation podcast showcasing new festival releases and the past films that inspired them. As a filmmaker myself, I started this podcast with the intention of building community while talking shop and to show love to past cinema that sparked a new wave of filmmakers to create the films of the future. Please like and subscribe to this podcast and follow us on social media at Past Present Feature. Thank you for listening. Let's roll it.
See you in rehearsal shots, you always look very fierce and, you know, practical, and you're on it. But actually, from listening to this, they've heard you're a walking comedian. You're on my show.
I have leaned into the comedy. I think I love Kathy and Stella so much because it allows me to tap into the goofy side of me. And anyone that's out there that has rehearsed with me, even in these fierce shows, knows that I love to create an atmosphere of safety and support, but it's usually done through humor. I hate it when the room is full of tension because I feel that nothing can really be created well or actually replicated well. You know, when you make people nervous or when you make people anxious, you might get what you want for those 2 minutes, but then you ask them to replicate that 8 shows a week and they can't because the cortisol levels in their bodies have changed. You know, So I really try my hardest to create a really warm and safe atmosphere, and I do it a lot through humor. And I think the beauty about Kathy and Stella is it's just a room full of goofballs, and we just bounce off of each other, and nobody ever really... Everything's up for grabs. Everything can be a joke. We take it very seriously, but I think what we're doing is we're taking the comedy very seriously, mm-hmm. and we're allowing ourselves to play. And then through that, we discover this incredible world where it's a little bit too loud and a little bit too rough around the edges, but it's absolutely brilliant. It's one of the things I'm the most proud of, but it is very, you're absolutely right. It's a complete and utter departure from anything I've ever done. Most of the choreography is on wheelie chairs. because at the time, I had no idea who I was working with, so I remember... asking John, like, you know, can they move? I don't know who these people are. I mean, I've heard of them, but I've never worked with them before. So I went in there thinking, okay, well, I'm just going to stick them on some wheelie chairs because that's always fun. You know, the second you sit on a wheelie chair in an office, you find yourself swiveling around or pushing your feet off to one side. Mm. And I just thought, what's more fun than that? So that's the basis of the whole show.
Yeah, just a bit of context for people who haven't seen it yet. We see these two hosts, these two friends who are hosting this murder... what do you call it? Murder mystery podcast, not murder mystery, like...
Murder podcast.
Like true crime.
True crime, yeah. Podcast, yeah.
Podcast, and they're on these two wheelie chairs together, chatting, living their best lives. So do you think, versus like reading it for the first time or discovering the material, to where it got to, even for that first run, did it change and evolve a lot?
Completely. Completely. I walked into a room in East London... upstairs in a studio, and I saw them all sat around a table, and Matthew, the composer, was playing, and John was sat next to me, and I was entranced. But it wasn't the whole show back then, but we were still in workshop phase. By the time we did it in Edinburgh, we had to reduce it down to 70 minutes, which was actually quite difficult. It's really difficult to reduce something to 70 minutes on the minute. And anyone that's done Edinburgh, and I hadn't, and I've learned so much, and I think anyone that hasn't done Edinburgh has to go and do Edinburgh. It is theatre magic. It's like walking into a magical land where everyone is excited about theatre.
On speed, yeah.
And it's fantastic. And I remember, you know, trying to create that show like a roller coaster and fit it all into 70 minutes and make it make sense. And, you know, we just thought, okay, let's see what we can do with this. The cast, even back then, was phenomenally gifted. And what we ended up with was a hit. And we were just like, we couldn't believe it. Like, we always knew. I remember saying to the cast, even in the studios in London, I feel something here, and I think it's good, and I think we're all going to look back in this, you know, back in time in this studio and go, that was special. And I know that it's special, but I didn't know that it was going to be this sort of fringe hit. And then the following year, we extended the cast. We brought it to Bristol Old Vic, gave it a set, brought it to Manchester Home. Now we've made even more changes. Yeah, I think
it's been quite a journey.
It's a massive journey, and it was never stop. We never stop. So even in the middle of the night, we'll start texting each other. I've got an idea. What about this? Or John will text me, or I'll text Matthew. And, you know, it's the West End is not ready for this level of comedy. It's fantastic. But and the two girls that helm it, mm-hmm. Bronte and Bex, are stars, absolute stars.
They are genius in these characters.
Yeah.
I mean, but they're two incredible, incredible roles. I mean, actually, how it paves way for women to be funny on stage is it's not only brilliant, but actually important, because it's not like a, oh, look at me. It's a severely witty, mm-hmm. very cleverly constructed sort of kind of female characters that are in this musical, which we don't literally see.
Yeah.
It's relatable, it's real. And There is nothing like it in terms of style. Oh, it's so exciting. So I first saw it I've only seen it once, and it was at Arts Ed when you invited some people to come and see, like, the dress rehearsal.
Right, yes. And that was before going to Fringe for the second year. And that was the Fringe production. So last year we rehearsed two different productions.
This is crazy.
Of it. We rehearsed this. We were allowed to do 90 minutes at the Fringe, as was we were at the Udderbelly. And then we knew that a couple of weeks after that, we were going into Bristol Old Vic, and that was going to be a two-act version. So the entire company knew both versions. Mm. And I don't know how their brains held on to it, because I couldn't. And our associate was, you know, Charlie Martin. She's just incredible. She drilled everything and made sure that everyone remembered which show we were doing on which night. And they were literally rehearsing two different versions at that same time. It was crazy.
I think it will sit really well in the West End. I think it's a breath of fresh air. And I think that, like we've kind of covered, people come and they'll experience something unlike they've experienced before in a very real way, which is what the most at the Fringe does best. Mm-hmm. And those smaller intimate venues do best. And you can almost replicate that. And the Ambassadors, which is a really nice intimate house still.
I love that theatre so much. I honestly, it's there are really no bad seats in that theater. Yeah. And anyone that usually doesn't want to sit in an upper circle, I implore you, go and sit in the upper circle. They're actually the best seats in the entire theater, because you see everything. I don't know how they've managed to do it, but this particular theater, there is literally not one bad seat, and we've sat in all of them now. We've literally run around sitting in all of them going, is this a good seat? Is that a good seat? And it's just the way it's constructed, and I think it's a brilliant home for it. And I think it's quite small backstage, but but it's going to burst onto that stage.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so meanwhile, you've got that going on in one side of your head. Other side of your head, you have Sunset Boulevard kind of taking over your life.
Yeah.
It's like a train, right? Rewind for me. When did you first hear about this? Because obviously you and Jamie had collaborated on Evita, mm-hmm. which was hugely acclaimed and spun Evita on its head to present it in a way that nobody had ever possibly considered that it could be presented in, right?
Yeah.
So how long did it take for them, you know, project number two to be bubbling away?
You know, it's really interesting. Jamie had a dream when we were doing Evita. And he came in one day during during previews or rehearsals during the preview period for Evita. And he said, I had a dream about Sunset Boulevard. And I was like, okay. And then he said, and I want to do it with Nicole Scherzinger. And I was like, okay. So it was, and he had seen it in his head like this fever dream. And although it wasn't as obviously as what it became on stage, it wasn't as specific, but he had seen so much of it in his head. So that seed was planted years ago. And I think once the pandemic was over, once things started to open up again, I remember I got a text from him and I was in rehearsals for something else. And he said, don't do anything. Don't commit to anything over this next period. And he gave me the dates and he said, because I want to do Sunset. We're going to do it. And I was like, okay, and sure.
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah. Well, you know, honestly, Jamie and I have become so close now. I always do call him my brother because we are very, very close. I think I'm one of the few people that sees into his brain in the most peculiar way. Wow. But I latch on and I think that's one of the reasons why we work so well together. There's a genuine respect and admiration for each other. And one of the best compliments I got on opening night of Sunset Boulevard was several people, but one particular person came up to me and said, I don't know where you end and Jamie begins or vice versa. And I haven't seen that for such a long time.
Wow.
And I think that's very, you know, that's what we've always tried to achieve. But I think it's gotten easier and easier over the years with me and Jay. So
Well, in one of the many speeches last night at the Olivier's, one of the creatives collecting awards thanked Jamie for his vision. And when I watched Sunset, it was one of those shows that screamed to me a clear vision and also an example of an entire creative team all being on the same page and creating something very cohesively, which actually isn't a comment which I make too often, you know. It's like, it's quite rare for me to see theatre and be like, wow, every single element was on the mark, was bang on together, was cohesive. So that original vision, that dream that he had, where did choreography sit there? Because what this show did in terms of choreography was mind-blowing.
Thank you. I mean, Jamie is an incredible collaborator, and I mean that in the true sense of the word. I've worked with so many people over the last couple of years that love to throw that word around, but actually he really understands what that word means and relies on the collaboration and begs for the collaboration to respectfully happen in the room. He'll always have a clear vision, but he enables us to freely create, and he treats us like artists. And I think when you do that in a room, you're only going to bring out the best of everybody. And that's from every department, from every person. And so, yes, even though the vision was quite, you know, in his head, was always there, that fever dream that he had. But when he turned to me and initially we started we always have hours and hours together, just the two of us, to kind of decide, okay, what's it going to be? What's this scene going to be? What's that scene going to be? And that's always how we've worked. And I can imagine that's how we're always going to work, because, you know, we can really let our hair down, close the door and just behave like buffoons and something's created. But that's what I mean. It's such a safe space that he creates. There were going to be no props. The set was going to be very minimal. So right off the bat, my job became, these bodies on stage are going to have to become the set. These bodies are going to have to become corridors for people to walk through. They're going to have to become pictures for people to be in the middle of. They're parties, houses, ghosts. I mean, you know, we created this one character that never existed before, young Norma. And then we constantly had this beautiful dancer, Hannah, who is just brilliant. I'd worked with her on Cabaret at the Lido. And as soon as we were in auditions, I reached out and I was like, what are you doing? You need to come in for this, because she's exquisite. And she's like every choreographer's muse. I mean, she's just absolutely, she's boneless. You know, the shapes that she's able to create on the stage, I was like, my mind was always blown, because I'd ask her to do something and then all of a sudden she'd be contorted in half and her head would be on the floor and I'd be like, yeah, just like that, Anna. You know, she's exquisite.
But that's a brilliant example of how the show was presented in such a different way, or it was flipped in its head. Because if you draw apart what preconceptions people have over Sunset, it is that Norma's this kind of washed up, kind of crazy woman, right? Mm. And there was elements of that being flipped away. And it's like, well, actually, was everyone... Maybe, I don't know how precise you all were and how much you wanted the audience to find their own interpretation, but it felt to me like there was roots in there to thinking about, hang on, is actually everyone around her, are they the problem? Is it... Who actually is the messed up person here? What is this actually saying about who she's a person and how women are treated and how they become the product of how the industry kind of spits them out almost. There's a lot of more nuanced almost takeaways to have from that production versus maybe more traditionally what
I think one of the things I discovered working in this sort of way is that when you take things away from the stage, when you take things away from the audience, you immediately allow them to go into their own minds. So they're filling in the gaps themselves. Yeah. So everyone's going to walk away with a different interpretation because there is no staircase.
Yeah.
There is no chimpanzee. You know, there's nothing for them to comment on. So they're immediately replacing it with their own mind. And I think that's why so many people have, in my opinion, have had such a visceral reaction to this production, because one person said that it was like being in the film themselves, like they felt like they were in it, you know, and that's fantastic. It's just
also in terms of tone, I think what always impressed me the most was how it was able to be cinematic and pay tribute to that side of the kind of the history almost that it's delving into, whilst also being camp and wink wink nudge nudge to a certain degree. You know, we weren't just like watching a film, we were watching something that very specifically was for theatre. And that was a kind of very clever juxtaposition to represent. Was that intentional?
Everything's intentional. And I have to say, Jamie has got a wonderfully amazing sense of humour. And anyone that gets to know him well sees it right away. I mean, to be fair, you see it right away in the rehearsal process, but he's got a wicked sense of humour. And it's, it's really cool what the kind of stuff that he's put into the show.
And then choreographically, it's not a show that we know for being a big, ambitious dancer.
No, I know. When we first talked about it, I said to him, I was like, what do you want me to do? You know, like...
Like, what's the musical numbers that
at? Well, and it's a lot to navigate. And I think Andrew Lloyd Webber's score it's actually one of the most beautiful scores. I mean, like, right from the beginning, that zoned, you know, it evokes so much emotion. But none of it's in eights. Very little of it you can count the way dancers are used to counting. And I had a taste of that in Evita with the rolling sevens in, and the money kept rolling in. So I know that that's kind of Andrew's thing, and it's genius and it's brilliant. But it's also can be quite tricky because the body loves to move in eights, especially because you've been trained to move in eights. And not a lot of this was, and there are a lot of sections of the score that have no lyrics to hold on to either. So it's not like you can ask a dancer, okay, you're going to do this to this lyric. You're asking a dancer to, can you hear that horn? Can you hear these strings? That's what you're aiming for. So that took a long time to get into everyone's bodies. But once we had it, once the room collectively locked in, it was really cool. Really cool. I loved it. I really loved it. But initially it was, how am I going to do this? This is, you know, but I love a challenge. And Jamie, I love how he challenges me.
Well, David Thaxton said to me when he did In the Frame about the work that then didn't make the final, what we finally saw, the final version. He was like, there was incredible choreography and incredible moments that we didn't even get to see. He was like, there was just so much creativeness, so much exploring going on that he kind of loved watching from his point of view. So it sounds like it was a mammoth.
It was a wonderful summer. and it really was. And we Like I said, Jamie allows us to play. And I think, you know, he refers to it as offerings. And, you know, it's you get to try again. If I've got a better idea, I've got a better suggestion, let me try this, let me try that. And, you know, he always stays on course and he always makes sure that everyone's on the same page. But he's very open to allowing other creatives to try something, you know. And there's a trust. There's an immediate trust with everybody. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful way to work. You know, he's the only person, and I've said this to him before, and I will say it again and again, but he's the only person in the industry that I drop everything for, and I'll go, okay, I'll do that.
Is there more... Has it repositioned your mind in terms of choreography broadly, more broadly towards the direction that musical theatre choreography is going on in this industry, i.e. the boundaries that we thought were there don't actually exist, that we can, we almost, there's a hunger, there's a appetite for musical theatre choreography to be completely transformed or to show us different things, to continue to push limits and show us different things, right? It's not what we once knew musical theatre choreography to be isn't what it is today.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you hit the nail on the head. I love not to be bored. And I think once you've seen something once, you want to see something new. And so why not push the boundaries? Why not discover new ways of doing stuff? Why not create different ways of telling, of retelling a story? And I think most creative, all creatives are storytellers of some sort. And I think, you know, gone are the days of once upon a time and 5, 6, 7, 8, you know. And I think those shows have a place, and I still enjoy watching them. But as someone who creates stuff, I'd like to wink at that and maybe take a little bit of it, but actually try to create something new. And I think this generation, maybe the last two generations, you know, we've got Netflix at our fingertips, Disney Plus, we've got all these amazing things. And then through the pandemic, we became even more attached to streaming and our iPhones and FaceTime and Zooms. And, you know, our brains work a lot faster than they used to. And so, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that and not just beat that down, because that's not going to go away anytime soon. And we can take a fresh breath, and we can say that theater's there to, you know, calm our minds. And a lot of it is. But I think when creating it, you're, in my head at least, I'm constantly competing with why would I leave the comfort of my own couch and my remote and my Apple TV to be here and watch this if this isn't a better experience? Do you see what I'm saying? So I try my hardest to create or help create something that's going to be a more exciting experience than watching the latest episode of the newest television series on Netflix. Because that's why people want to come to the theater as well. They want to have that sense of community. They want to create a space for them all to enjoy something together. And there's nothing like live theater, but times have changed. So we've got to make, it's not just about all sitting around a campfire anymore and feeling each other. We've also got to give them something that's going to work that part of their brain so that when they leave, they feel elated.
I think it's almost, I keep talking about event theatre. Mm-hmm. They want the Instagram photo, they want that story to tell their friends or that thing to post about. They want that, the inn, we need something unique. And Sunset Boulevard was totally an event as well as a run. But you look at things like Guys and Dolls or Mamma Mia the Party. I mean, from all different angles and all different ways, these shows are getting
Nicole
people
said
in.
That in her speech, in her award speech last night, didn't she? She said, and Jamie, you created an art installation.
Yes.
You know, and that's very much how it felt to all of us, you know. And also working with Nicole, you know, it's fascinating because she comes from this incredible pop world where every night is an event. Because, you know, you see that her history in being on stage is a nightly event, for that audience to come to a stadium to watch that event. You know, you're not just doing, oh, this is show number 6 of an 8-show week. This is, tonight is the new time. It's another event. And it shifts everything right away. The whole energy changes.
Totally.
You know, so I learned a lot from her, and she's such an amazing cheerleader.
Well, incredible. What a moment. I mean, there's so many sub moments coming out of this show, this event. But also, I went back to see it again when Rachel Tucker did a show, and how that flipped the whole thing on its head and presented it in a different way was fascinating. Unlike I've experienced before from seeing different performers take on the same role, you know, it was a completely different thing as well. It was fascinating.
Yeah, it was beautiful being able to work with Rachel Tucker as well. I mean, I've known Rachel for so many years. We did We Will Rock You Together as performers, and it was such it was such a wonderful experience being able to work together again. And you know, when I was there in the studio tangoing with her and just looking at each other in the face going, can you believe where we are right now? It was amazing to work with her again. She's just got the biggest heart and the biggest pipes in the business. She's just incredible. I adore her.
What was that Olivier Awards night like for you? What was it like? Because, I mean, you've had some time away, and I know you've been back working on it again since getting ready for America. But what a moment to celebrate and to come together and to almost, I guess, feel from the whole industry that kind of level of appreciation and respect and admiration for what you created.
It was incredible. It was a wonderful night. It really was. I mean, I'm not going to lie and say that I wasn't absolutely full of anxiety, because that I was. And I think it's easier to enjoy these things when you're just a guest. And the second you're a nominee, there's this sort of feeling of like, oh my God, I've got to go up there maybe. And what would I say? And there's this always this ball of anxiety that lives in your stomach. But it was the first time I was at an event like it since the pandemic. I didn't get to go to the Olivier's for Evita, even though we were nominated, and I was nominated because the COVID took it all away. So I wasn't able to celebrate that. So it was a beautiful way to just, with a similar group of people, definitely with Jamie and Alan, to be able to go in together and have that moment on the green carpet and have that moment to kind of celebrate. And then being able to see Arlene before the show, and Mark and Ellen Kane, you know, like, it was, I have such an admiration for everyone in that category, in my category anyway.
Incredible category, and all people who have been, it's like insane. What we just discussed, Ellen, Arlene, just completely making strides in terms of musical theatre choreography and what we can see from it. It's actually a really exciting time.
It was beautiful. And there was a moment where I remember I'd hugged almost everyone. I didn't get a chance to see Susan Stroman. I don't think she was over. But I saw everyone else. And, you know, and I remember giving Drew McConey a hug. Mm. And I just thought, this is incredible. This group of, I'm actually friends with these other choreographers, you know, and it's really weird because we get all put into this, jumbled into these award ceremonies like the What's on Stage Awards or the Olivier's or whatnot. And it's almost like the nomination day is always brilliant, you know, and it's very exciting, full of tears and whatnot. And then as you creep up towards the Olivier's, you know, there's going to be one winner. And even though you're told and you tell yourself it's about the nomination, but there's always that, well, what's the opposite of a winner, you know, feeling in the back of your head. But last night was so magical because there's such a tight community of movement directors and choreographers, and there's such a high respect for each other's work and admiration for each other's work. And I think that's what I love about working in the UK, in London particularly.
It's special.
It is very special. There's no sort of animosity. There's no sort of, you know, it should have been me, it should have been her. It really is warm and wonderful. Mm. I mean that. It's great.
Yeah, and long may that continue. Mm. And you've got more of that to come with the whole Broadway community. It's all going to be happening.
That's crazy, isn't it? It's so crazy. It's Broadway is fast and furious, and just New York itself is loud and a lot, and it's incredibly overwhelming to think that we're going to be back there soon And
you're there to do a job.
We're there to do a job. And it's and the Broadway community is already talking about it. And everyone's very excited about it. So it's a very exciting time. Mm. I think they're going to be very surprised in the best possible way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's really, I can't wait to see how people respond, what the buzz is like. Because it's, again, I think it's so, so exciting.
Yeah.
But listen, as exciting as that is and all these other things are, call me basic, I don't care.
Okay.
But what I'm most excited to talk about is you choreographing Wicked.
Oh.
And like, was that the first non-replica?
Non-replica, yeah.
Production. Where was it again?
Hamburg.
And you were unleashed. You were the person who got to be unleashed on that title, Fabian.
So that threw me. We were in the pandemic. We were in lockdown. And Stephen Schwartz reached out to me.
How did you know him?
I've known Stephen. Oh, so we're going way back now. But I was one of the original dancers in Disney's Glockner von Notre Dame in Berlin.
Wow.
Hunchback of Notre Dame. And that's when I had met Stephen Schwartz, and I was very, very young. And then when I did Working here at Southwark Playhouse, I got a chance to meet him again and rekindle our friendship. And then he's an incredibly, wonderfully warm human being and a massive cheerleader. So when this opportunity was placed into his lap, he reached out to me, and I was like, yes, absolutely. I had lived in Hamburg for about 6 years, wow, on and off, when I moved from Australia to Hamburg. So I knew it very well. And I just thought this would be incredible. And I mean, the German system for what they did for COVID was it just enabled everyone to continue working because their safety protocols were so on point. So we created the show. We were all tested daily and then like twice, full on PCR twice a week.
Wow.
And masked up. I mean, Elphaba was fully masked, singing Defying Gravity, fully masked. And I worked with the amazing director, Lindsay Posner, and the designer, John Bosser. And it was just an incredible experience. We created the show. And then when we finally were able to open up, we came back. We froze the show, came back, and reopened it to the public.
But not a title you probably ever thought you'd be getting your hands on.
No way. No way. And I remember when Stephen asked me about it, I said, where is it going? And when he told me it was Hamburg, I was like, okay. And he went, why should that matter? And I said, because I'm not doing it in the UK.
Yeah.
And I said, because you know the show's a hit, right, Stephen? Like, it's a big hit. And I don't want people to compare, you know, a version that I've choreographed to the original version. Because it's, you know, it's very easy to revive something that has been asleep for a very long time,
yeah,
that very few people remember, or even to revive something that didn't do so well. And you kind of, okay, let's breathe some new life into it. But to take an existing show that was currently on Broadway, currently in the West End, currently on 7 national tours around, you know, in Japan, in Korea, in Australia, and then say, we're going to do a new one. I was like, oh.
Well, everyone knows. I mean, the choreography is quite iconic in Wicked. Like,
exactly.
It's very specific.
Wayne Cilento.
Very specific movement-driven. There's a whole kind of language within the choreography that production speaks, and everyone knows it. But is it almost hard to get that out of your head? And how do you go about then thinking of it afresh? But was there a strong vision you were presented with?
There was an absolute strong vision. Both Lindsay and John had a sort of, okay, this is the idea, this is the look, you know, and it was very futuristic. There had this sort of really weird Blade Runner-y quality to it. Mm. Because when you say things like Oz, well, what does that mean to everybody? And the thing is one of the big calling points for me to go to Germany was that the movie, The Wizard of Oz, is not a big deal in Germany.
Interesting.
Yeah. So all of the things that link Wicked up to the Wizard of Oz, they never really picked up on. They know of it and they know the story, but it's not something that everybody watches every Christmas.
Yeah.
It's not in the same realm as it is here in the UK.
Yeah, in the US. The US was even bigger almost. Yeah.
So certain jokes would just go over their head. You know, like, oh, who takes shoes off a body? What, were you raised in a barn? Over your head. You know, melons and pears and apples, oh my, over their head. Like, nobody would care about those jokes. No laughs, not even a titter, you know? And so when we created it, we were creating it with, okay, this is going to be a standalone musical. So now we have to explain why this story is important without latching it completely to The Wizard of Oz. And that's where we started from. So there were a lot of things that we did very differently. One of my proudest things that Stephen Schwartz, when he finally came over to see it, was I did a new version of Wonderful where I used Chistery, the monkey, and the wizard and Chistery did this sort of like vaudevillian dance that was a throwback to maybe when the wizard was back in Kansas doing his, you know, and then... Clever. And then...
Oh my God, that's so clever.
Elphaba says stop halfway through because the monkey goes wrong and the wizard goes to hit the monkey and she says stop. And then she says, okay, I'll do it as long as you let all the animals go. And Stephen, we went to breakfast the next morning and he was like, I don't know why we never did that before. Hmm. And I was like, okay, well, I'll take that. I'll take that. But yeah, there were a lot of little cool little things that we threw into the show. And the biggest one, of course, was that she flies. And that was epic. And it took hours, absolute hours and hours to hide everything, to link her up, to hook her up onto the wires.
The people who haven't seen it, she literally flew over
the audience.
And then did she go up at the end or?
Completely to the back of the balcony.
Like, that's where she
disappears on her broom, back of the balcony. Goes. And, first cover. And and we were scared about her losing her voice and what does it feel like. And then, you know, we had this incredible first cast, Elphaba Vyen, and she's an incredible Dutch performer and vocals for days. But she says, I asked her, are you okay up there? How's your voice? And she went, it's easier. She said, it's easier for somehow because of the support that the harness gives me support on my diaphragm. And I just feel like the second I'm lifted up, it feels easier for me. So we were like, great, let's go with that and hoist you over top of the audience.
Tighten that harness.
I know. So, but yeah, that took hours and hours. But the payoff was
epic
because the audience went ballistic, absolutely ballistic every night. And just creating the choreography for it. What do you do when you get to do anything you want? What is an Aussian movement? What are these creatures? What are munchkins? You know, so there's no structure. No rules. Everything's upside down, and it should be. And so what do you do? Okay, well, let's try things that are upside down. Let's try to, you know. So that was really exciting. Yeah, it was a really special time, actually. And it kept me going through COVID because without it, I think I would have gone absolutely stir crazy.
It truly is like, that's musical theatre history, like a major, major moment. Because now more of those international productions have popped up, but that was the first one.
Yeah.
But every time someone else does it, I get so excited for the, you know, for little trailers to pop and production images to pop up because it's fascinating.
Fascinating, and it just goes to show that the actual material itself is so close to everyone's heart. And we love the story of these two friends, these two women that find comfort with each other. Mm. And not to segue, but that's, I think, one of the reasons why Kathy and Stella speak so much to other people. Because we've got, I mean, obviously Kathy and Stella is very different, but because they have a complete codependency. and we discover halfway through the show that it's not a healthy one. But it's, you know, I think people love that story of true friendship.
Well, and especially female friendship. It's just not something, again, that you see on stage with Kathy and Stella's rarity. It's like Frozen taking off massively internationally as well.
Yeah.
Like Wicked did. that there are very few stories that are told which center around the friendship between two women, be it healthy or unhealthy,
yeah,
in whatever way. Yeah. It's important because that's something that is true in lots of people's everyday life.
It is. It really is. And I think, and it's interesting because Kathy and Stella, I think, will speak to, you know, both men, women, to non-binary people. I mean, the friendship quality of what they have, whether it's the codependency or when they discover ways of actually being themselves, which happens halfway through, you know, it's something that everyone can relate to. It's human. You know, we all have that one person that we are drawn to, mm-hmm. that we are closest to. That's our best bud. That's our brother, our sister, our partner, you know. So it's a story that I think everyone can relate to.
Seeing how passionate you are about this show, do you think it's almost, it's an element of it, having opened up your mind, your eyes into other projects that you'd like to be a part of, almost like broadening your horizons, maybe exploring some more directing further down the line? Has it not made you ambitious, but just almost kind of broadened what you thought the sort of project you would say yes to might be?
Yeah, I think so. I absolutely think so. I mean, I would definitely, I'm not scared of direction. I think it'd have to be the perfect project. I think there's a more of a culture of choreographers that direct in the USA than there is here.
With Jerry Mitchells and stuff.
I mean, it's...
We have Drew McConey, though, like, almost.
We definitely have people that have crossed over. But it's definitely in the fabric of the USA. Bob Fosse, Jerome Robbins, Susan Stroman, Rob Marshall. I mean, the list is endless. Yes, and they all started off as dancers and then choreographers. Yeah. Casey Nicola, you know. Whereas here, it doesn't happen as much, but it does happen. So I guess in the States, I'd probably just go, yep, absolutely. Let me give it a try. But I think here it would probably have to speak to me in a way that, okay, why should I be the one that tells that story? But to be fair, I think that's something that I would ask myself even in the US. Why should I be the one that tells that story? And then if I can connect to it on a level that goes beyond just choreography or movement, then I think it's probably the story for me. If that makes sense. Mm. And that's what I discovered doing Kathy and Stella. For some reason, working with those people, collaborating with this group of people, working with Francesca, I knew, yes, I can do this. And, you know, regardless whether people like it or don't, I know I can absolutely tell this story. Mm. I'd have to be the right one.
I think that's important. You don't want to do it for the sake of just doing it and having your name up in lights or getting that credit,
well,
do you?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, a girl's got to eat, right? So sometimes you take the one that you're like, well, sure, okay, let's do that one. What's it about? A slug. I don't know anything about it. Let's try. You know, but I think there, as I get a little bit more mature with my choices, that is the important thing. Why am I the one that's telling this story? What makes me the right person to tell this story? And then once you can answer that question, it opens up the floodgates of creativity, I think.
Yeah. I think that's important. Because truly, even beyond Kathy and Stella, when I talked about at the beginning, the things you've done since Evita, since we last spoke, that surprised me, even like in Dreams, completely different style of show. And then the creativity that went into SpongeBob. I mean, these are all completely different projects that are coming across your desk.
I just love variety. Like I said, you know, maybe my brain has been Netflixified or whatever you want to call it, but I do love variety. I love the ability to... I mean, SpongeBob was complete kookiness. It's just...
You've got to get it all out your system.
It's goofing around on stage. Cabaret at the Lido was such a big deal for me. I've always wanted to work on that show. And to be able to do it in such a massive venue, in such an iconic venue, was a blessing. And we finally got to do Bring It On as well.
The choreography of Bring It On was insane.
You know, we had two cheerleaders. And everybody else had to learn. The entire company had to learn how to cheerlead. And so by the time we opened at the South Bank Center and we were doing stuff that, you know, throwing people in the air, doing backflips in the air, catching them in, you know, basket tosses. And it was, it was incredible. And I was so proud of that company. And I remember a moment when they finished Cross the Line, which is in the second act, and we started getting towards the end of the run, because obviously we closed because of
so sad.
Omicron.
Yeah.
But before we actually closed towards that last couple of weeks at the South Bank, and we get to Cross the Line and there would be a full standing ovation. And I remember thinking to myself, they have earned that standing ovation because the audience was not expecting it to be that level of athleticism, that level of like, look at what they've just achieved. And I can honestly, with my hand on my heart, say two cheerleaders out of all of them. They worked like
dogs. And actually, to ask that first 10-minute number, it's almost like the bar's been set. Where do you possibly go from there?
Well, yeah.
But then you look at that alongside In Dreams, couldn't be a more different show.
I mean, In Dreams was magical, though, because it was Luke Shepherd managed to get a whole bunch of Latinx people in a room. And I have to say, it was brilliant. It was brilliant. I tapped into my heritage. I was able to work with people from all over South America, you know, from Mexico to Colombia to Puerto Rico. You know, we were just, and we'd have the best times. And it was wonderful to walk into a studio where, you know, people were saying good morning to each other in Spanish. And it was just like, it was incredible. So, you know, thanks to him, that was a beautiful experience with regards to that. Mm. Yeah, well, that's fantastic.
Another incredible director as well, with an incredible mind. He's very busy.
Yeah, I've known Luke for years. We did Matilda together, so that relationship is quite an old one, yeah.
Yeah, you were two people who kind of came out of Matilda.
And Ellen, you know, like there's been a lot of people that have sprouted out of these, you know, massive, well, what have become massive shows, you know, and I think that's... It's important for us to remember that as we go forward, there's always going to be those associates, those residents that are learning, because they're going to be the next ones that go off and do the next great thing or the next project or the next company, you know, and it's important to kind of allow those people to flourish in whatever you're doing now, you know.
Are you able, right here, right now, I don't mean to freak you out, but how do you look forward? How do you deal with everything that's on your to-do list that you've got to achieve and go through over the next 2 to 6 months or even 2 to 6 days? Fabian breaks down in tears.
No, I honestly love working. I love working. And I think one of the things that the pandemic taught me was I missed working. I absolutely love working. To work. Maybe I'm a workaholic. Maybe that's a bad thing. I don't know. For me, it's definitely theater is, you know, Hannah Waddingham said last night, like it's a bug and it bites you. And then once it bites you, I feel even more like it's a calling. You know, I came out knowing exactly what I wanted to do. And when you wait as long as a performer does for that first chance to do it, you hold on to it. Mm. With really, really tightly, you know. And I think as a creative, after so many years of pandemics and having stuff pulled away from you and out of your grasp, now that it's on the table, you just make time for it. And, you know, if those things overlap, they overlap. And if you're tired, at least it's like what my grandmother used to say, if you're tired at the end of the day because you've been working hard, then you know why you're tired and you're going to sleep well. Mm. You know what I mean? So I would rather that than anything else. So I welcome it, he says. I welcome it.
Bring it on.
Bring it on.
One of your shows. Listen, thank you for taking a punt on me 5 years ago on episode 4 of In the Frame.
That's crazy.
The things that have been discussed in this booth since. But then thank you for coming back 5 years
ago. My pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
We mustn't leave for as long next time. I have something for you. I didn't give this gift to to guests. Why can't I talk? 5 years ago. Let me hold your mic. Open that. See what's in there.
Okay.
No one goes away empty-handed anymore.
Wow.
Wow.
Oh, I love it.
Yay!
Yes. Oh, see? Leveled up. Leveled up. It's a West End frame mug that I will be having my cup of tea in.
We love a journey.
I love it. Look at that. Everyone's leveling up and I'm here for it.
A gift from me to you. Listen, thank you so much, Fabian.
It's my pleasure.
Good luck with Kathy and Stella. Everyone needs to come and see it. It's an incredible show. So different at the West End. I'm so excited. And then Sunset on Broadway.
Yeah, bring it on. Let's do it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can see Kathy and Stella at the Ambassadors Theatre from the 25th of May through to the 14th of September. Sunset Boulevard begins performances on Broadway on the 28th of September. A huge thank you to Fabian for taking time out of his busy schedule to record this episode of In the Frame. It was such a pleasure to have him back. And I was even more grateful that he came in literally the morning after being at the Olivier Awards. Make sure you subscribe, follow, rate and review to In The Frame wherever you are listening. And whilst you're there, check out our other podcast, The West End Frame Show, for your weekly stagey catch-up. You can follow West End Frame on Instagram and TikTok, and I'll be back next week with another incredible guest. But until then, thank you for listening.